the intention of the state of Myanmar has been to destroy Rohingya as a group.
Myanmar faces a legal challenge to charges of genocide. It's Monday, December 9th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, much of Australia remains on fire. A question of compensation for rideshare drivers. A tighter race for the White House. Lowered life expectancy and a canine solution. It's all on today's VOA Asia. An attorney assisting Gambia with its lawsuit against Myanmar alleging state-sponsored genocide at the UN's top court says he is confident the West African nation will win the case based on copious, strong evidence of army atrocities against Muslim Rohingyas. In the lawsuit, Muslim-majority Gambia accuses Myanmar of breaching the 1948 Genocide Convention for the brutality military-led crackdown on the Rohingya in 2017 that left thousands dead and drove more than 740,000 across the border into Bangladesh. The West African country took the legal action on behalf of the 57-member Organization of Islamic Cooperation. The first public hearings at the ICJ will be held this week, beginning Tuesday. Paul Reichler is an attorney at Foley Hogue LLC in Washington, which is representing Gambia. Reichler spoke with Radio Free Asia's Myanmar's correspondents.
The fact that Myanmar denies its responsibility for committing genocide is what makes this a dispute and shows why it's necessary to go to the International Court of Justice as an impartial third party, the world's highest judicial authority, to determine the truth, to determine, based on the evidence and the law, whether the Gambia is right in alleging that Myanmar is guilty of committing genocide. The evidence is plentiful. There are many, many fact-finding reports by UN missions, by special rapporteurs, by human rights organizations. There is satellite photography. And there are many, many statements by officials and army personnel from Myanmar, which all together show that the intention of the state of Myanmar has been to destroy the Rohingya as a group, in whole or in part. And we're very confident that at the end of the day, that the evidence will be so compelling that the court will agree with the Gambia.
The Myanmar authority also assert that this lawsuit is mean violation of national integrity and sovereignty. So how valid are these statements?
States are sovereign, to be sure, and Myanmar is a sovereign state. But when states voluntarily become parties to international treaties and international conventions, they voluntarily accept the obligations as well as the rights that pertain to them under those conventions. Myanmar is a party to the Genocide Convention. It has been a party since Burma ratified the convention many, many years ago, and it has remained a party, and therefore it voluntarily accepted the obligations that every party has under that convention not to commit genocide against any group of people based on their ethnicity, religion, race, or other factors.
A portion of Radio Free Asia's interview with Paul Reichler. He's an attorney at Foley Hogue LLC in Washington, which is representing Gambia. Myanmar has largely denied that its military was responsible for the violence in Rakhine State, which included indiscriminate killings, mass rape, torture, and village burnings, and has defended the crackdown as legitimate counterinsurgency against a group of Muslim militants. The government has also dismissed credible evidence in numerous reports and satellite imagery that points to the atrocities and claim that the Rohingya burned down their own communities and blame soldiers for the destruction. These are among some of the top Asia headlines that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. President Trump warns North Korea's Kim on hostile actions. Hundreds of thousands of protesters pack Hong Kong streets. Myanmar leader Suu Kyi departs for genocide hearings amid fanfare at home. Pentagon chief plans to shift U.S. focus to China and Russia. Philippines bamboo entrepreneur digs in on poverty and climate threats. You can read and watch more on VOA Asia Facebook and Twitter, plus the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. 140 bushfires continue to burn across eastern Australia. A huge blaze near Sydney is bigger in size than the city itself, and it could take weeks to put out. Although conditions eased Saturday, the dangers persist. Phil Mercer in Sydney has more.
Sydney is again shrouded in a toxic, smoky haze. Health warnings have been issued, and many weekend sporting activities have been cancelled. Several blazes have combined to create a mega fire north of Australia's biggest city. The fire's front is 60 kilometres long, and officials warn it's simply too big to put out. Lauren McGowan works in a bar in the nearby city of Cessnock.
Everyone's a bit on edge. It's getting a little bit too close to home for around here. Like, even like people that we have working here, the fire's practically on their doors.
There are 95 bushfires here in the drought-hit state of New South Wales. Half are burning out of control. More than 2,000 firefighters are on the ground. Their task is unrelenting, but reinforcements have arrived from overseas, including Canada, New Zealand and the United States. Morgan Kerr, a senior firefighter from Edmonton, has flown in to join his Australian counterparts, who have in previous years battled blazes in Canada.
First time away from Christmas, as it is with all of these guys. Certainly a tough conversation, but we're happy we've been assisted four times out of the last 5 years.
There are hazardous conditions in Queensland to the north. Parts of that state are blanketed in smoke and dozens of blazes still rage. The World Health Quality Index, a non-profit environmental project based in China that measures global pollution, has shown unhealthy levels of air quality in many areas. Authorities say that only heavy rain will put some of the fires out, but ominously, the forecast is for more hot and dry conditions over the Australian summer. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia news, U.S. President Donald Trump has warned North Korean leader Kim Jong-un against hostile military actions, even as Pyongyang announced it had conducted a, quote, very important test at a satellite launching site. North Korea state media said the test was conducted Saturday near the border of China. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're starting out a brand new week. We're glad you're with us on VOA Asia. Perhaps you've thought about, or actually do, drive for a rideshare company such as Uber and Lyft. Those companies and others have changed transportation in hundreds of cities around the world, allowing people with vehicles to earn money as drivers while giving commuters an alternative means of travel. But are the rideshare drivers fairly compensated? Do they work for Uber and Lyft as employees, or are they considered as independent contractors? A new proposed law in California aims to settle the matter, but critics say it raises as many questions as it answers. In Los Angeles, Mike O'Sullivan explores what's steering the legislation.
A protest in Los Angeles in November.
I believe that we will win.
I believe that we will win.
Like protesters who rallied in September, these Uber and Lyft drivers want better pay, health care, paid vacation, and other benefits. Right now, drivers only earn a cut of their fares plus tips.
We made $100, $200, $300 a day. But when you deduct all the expenses, how much you pay for gas, if you change your oil, how much you pay for your car wash.
She says there's not much left. And are the drivers business owners or employees? A California law that takes effect in January tries to answer the question, but all sides say the matter has not been settled. One driver who works for Uber and Lyft doesn't want to be an employee of either company.
It's going to limit my income. It's going to limit my freedom on being able to be king of my schedule.
But the relationship, says a labor analyst, is one-sided.
If you are an independent contractor, you come into the room, you bring a contract, and then you negotiate the conditions of the work. With Uber and Lyft drivers, there's a template. You basically have to say yes.
In September, California Governor Gavin Newsom signed a bill to impose strict tests to distinguish contractors from employees in many fields.
It can be a construction worker. It can be a nail salon worker, janitors. It can be other more professional skills. Some of them got carved out.
Some are exempted, including doctors and lawyers. Worried truckers who want to stay independent also want an exemption. And restaurants that rely on internet-based delivery services say it will hurt business.
That's a brick and mortar that's actively engaging to expand their business through technology, and that needs to be supported and protected at all costs.
Uber and Lyft say that forcing drivers into a traditional job structure hurts drivers.
That limits their flexibility. And we know from research that at least 75% of these drivers want to remain flexible.
Uber, Lyft, and the food delivery company DoorDash are spending $30 million each to promote a compromise measure, which they hope to qualify for next year's election ballot. It would offer a guaranteed base wage and other benefits and provide for better screening and safety training for drivers. Critics say there are too many loopholes. In response to driver protests, a New York law that took effect last February guarantees drivers more than $17 an hour plus payments for distance.
We've seen that the driver pay has gone up since that time. The companies are now limiting the number of new drivers into the system, and fares aren't that different from what they were before.
In California and other places, both sides say the issues will be resolved through negotiation, fine-tuning local and state laws, challenges in court, and at the ballot box. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Coming up, the race for the White House narrows. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program hosts VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. Hundreds of thousands of protesters packed the streets of Hong Kong Sunday to mark 6 months of an unprecedented sweeping anti-government movement in this Chinese-ruled semi-autonomous city. The police-sanctioned march was largely peaceful, but tensions escalated later. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories like this. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, the Democratic presidential field continues to shrink. The latest casualty, California Senator Kamala Harris, who withdrew from the race last week. Earlier, Montana Governor Steve Bullock also ended his campaign. Former Vice President Joe Biden leads a cluster of four contenders near the top of the national public opinion polls, but there's still plenty of uncertainty about where the Democratic race is headed as the campaign heats up. VOA National Correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
This week marked the end of the campaign trail for California Senator Kamala Harris.
So here's the deal, guys. My campaign for president simply does not have the financial resources to continue, and the financial resources we need to continue.
Harris had an early impact on the race and frequently targeted President Donald Trump in the Democratic primary debates.
You have used hate, intimidation, fear, and over 12,000 lies as a way to distract from your failed policies and your broken promises.
But Harris fell into single digits of support in recent polls and had trouble breaking into the top tier of Democratic candidates, led in national opinion polls by former Vice President Joe Biden. Biden also focuses on Trump in his campaign.
The America's kind of had an epiphany lately with this guy because they now realize what they have lost and what is in sight of losing more of. And I believe that's going to energize an entire nation in a way that hasn't been energized before.
Joining Biden in the top tier are South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Buttigieg has done well in recent polls in the early voting states of Iowa and New Hampshire, but the race remains unpredictable, with voting to begin in Iowa on February 3rd. Vanderbilt University analyst Thomas Schwartz.
There's still a possibility of someone else emerging in the caucuses. I think it's uncertain. I mean, Joe Biden, it's still Joe Biden's race to lose in some ways, that he still dominates in the national polls. But he is not the overwhelming favorite that Hillary Clinton was in 2016.
At the moment, Democratic voters appear to be split between moderate contenders like Biden, Buttigieg, and Senator Amy Klobuchar, and more liberal candidates like Warren, Sanders, and New Jersey Senator Cory Booker. That dynamic is likely to play out in the voting that begins in February, says analyst John Fortier.
That's going to be an interesting contrast for the one part of the party who might want somebody who's more to the middle of the party. And another part that looks for someone like Elizabeth Warren, who's more to the left.
Even as Harris leaves the race, two other Democrats have joined the campaign in recent weeks, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick and former New York City mayor and billionaire Michael Bloomberg. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
This news break from VOA Asia, Myanmar leader and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Aung San Suu Kyi departed Sunday for the UN's top court in The Hague to defend the country against charges of genocide for its Rohingya Muslim minority. The hearings are set for this week, Tuesday through Thursday. Visit VOA Asia on YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a new study is sounding the alarm on the decline in life expectancy in the United States. Although it says that has increased by almost 10 years over the past six decades, close to 79 years, it has dropped for three consecutive years since 2014. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo spoke with the co-author of the study.
The overall decrease in life expectancy has been driven by an increase in mortality among the working age group of 24 to 65-year-olds, says Stephen Wolf, who co-authored the report.
A big piece of this is an increase in deaths from drug overdoses. That has been one of the biggest drivers of the trend.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, on average, 130 Americans died every day from an opioid overdose in 2017. However, this is not the only ill that cut American lives short.
There's been increases in death rates in that same age group for alcoholism, for suicides, for dozens of organ system diseases. And I'm referring to things like diabetes and lung disease and heart disease. That has also increased in this same age group. Altogether, we counted 35 causes of death.
John Hager of the National Institute on Aging says this is unprecedented.
Demographers have their hair on fire. This is a big deal. We haven't seen something like a decline in life expectancy in this country since the early years of the AIDS epidemic. And before that, in the great years of the international flu epidemic after World War I.
But he also says the decline in life expectancy is the combination of a process that's been decades in the making.
This has been going on for a long time. The U.S. has been falling behind other countries in mortality improvements in these very direct and visible measures of health status for decades.
It's important to treat the symptoms as well as the underlying cause of health problems, says Wolf.
In addition to developing policies for drug addiction and for alcoholism and for suicides, we need to step back and ask ourselves, what is it about living conditions in America that's driving people to these behaviors? Why do they have so much pain that they're turning to painkillers? What is responsible for the desperation that's leading to suicides? Why is their diabetes so poorly controlled?
Something echoed by John Hager.
We spend about double the European average on health sector. It's a $3.5 trillion industry in the United States. No other country comes close. Where we're really falling down is in preventive care and all the things people should be doing, physical activity, a good diet, attending to health problems early.
The study was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
As the Centers for Disease Control says, Americans are dying younger and life expectancy is down. One tactic to reversing the trend might be to call dogs to the rescue. VOA's Carol Pearson reports that research on dogs may help us reverse the aches and pains of aging.
Dogs are so attuned to humans that many people think of them as family. Sandy Schrager fits in that category.
I can't imagine, you know, my life without them. So they're just a central point part of my life.
Come on, girl. Let's go.
According to a pet owner's survey, there are some 90 million pet dogs in the United States. The University of Washington is recruiting 10,000 of them for a study on aging. Professor Daniel Promislow at the University School of Medicine explains.
The goal is to follow dogs for their entire lives, young, old, big, small, males, females, all dogs all around the U.S., to understand how the biology and the environment shape healthy aging in dogs.
The University of Washington, which is on the west coast of the U.S., is partnering with veterinarians like Dr. Kate Creevy at Texas A&M University.
By studying aging in pet dogs living in human environments, we can learn things that will translate to human health as we age in a shorter period of time, and will also directly benefit companion dogs along the way, which is extremely important to me as a veterinarian.
Dogs and humans age in much the same way. They have a similar genome and get the same diseases as they age. Cancer is a big one. As pets, dogs share our environment, so they're exposed to the same toxins as their owners. Researchers plan to examine the dog's lifestyle factors that also affect humans, such as diet, activity level, and where the dog lives, in addition to genetics and medical history. Matt Caberlin is one of the researchers at the University of Washington. He says one of the goals is to find out how to prevent age-related diseases.
Traditionally, in medicine, we have waited until people are sick, and then we try to do something about it. We try to cure their disease, or we try to at least alleviate the symptoms. The goal here is really to keep dogs and people healthy as long as possible before they get sick. And I think that this is kind of a really important aspect of targeting the biology of aging directly rather than targeting individual diseases as they happen.
The researchers plan to make the study's findings available to all scientists. One day, age-related cancers or even dementia will be a thing of the past. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find us on social media. We're on YouTube. We're also on Instagram and, of course, Facebook at VOA Asia. And we also have a Twitter account. It's also named VOA Asia. You can also hear us on the radio, PSU, Radio Patani FM 107.25 at Prince of Songkla University in Thailand. We say hello to everyone listening there today. Thanks for joining us. Come back again tomorrow. We'd also like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Kelvin Fowler, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.